Greetings. Can everybody hear me? Excellent. I'm very excited to talk to you on this panel about federalism, subsidiarity, and the common good. As David mentioned, I do have a book out recently on subjects adjacent to this, and to paraphrase G.K. Chesterton, an author will discuss a new book upon the feeblest of provocations. And obviously, addressing the Philadelphia Society exceeds that threshold. However, I am going to zag instead of zig and not talk about my book. Instead, I'm going to talk about something much more interesting. A new debate on the American right that is, in fact, an old debate on the American right. This is the debate about whether freedom or virtue ought to be our first public principle. Now we know that, broadly, the libertarian wing of American conservatism prefers to put liberty first, and the traditionalist wing of the conservative movement supports putting goodness first. This question of ordered liberty has never been without internecine conflicts. That is good. Disagreement is good. Contention is good. Groupthink is for leftists. My contention is hardly original, but it is one that I think that we need to consider anew. There is no inherent tension between freeing, being free, and being virtuous, as Paul convincingly talked to you about a moment ago. In fact, I think the American experiment itself is predicated on an institutional resolution to the implied tension. Federalism and subsidiarity, governing less and governing locally, are essential components of that institutional architecture. The paradigm we know as fusionism, hailing from the post-World War II consensus of American conservatives, is usually understood as a simple coalitional strategy, a big tent political movement gathering together small government types, traditionalist types, and fierce anti-communists to achieve shared policy goals. But this was never the heart of the fusionist contention. Instead, fusionism asserted the fundamental harmony between goodness and freedom. For a fusionist, the patrimony of Jerusalem, Athens, and Rome, with valuable supplements filtered through London, Edinburgh, and finally Philadelphia, consisted in a shared emphasis on both of these values, neither of which is negotiable. The American settlement rests on two pillars. The first pillar is human dignity. Because each of us bears the image of God, our coercive institutions ought not compel fellow citizens into a life of virtue. There are things we simply may not do to other human beings, even for their own good. The second pillar, however, is self-governance. Communities do have a right to pursue some shared vision of the good without undue interference from outside parties. Political consent is an important part of self-governance, but there are deeper and more humane forms of consent than plebiscites. Traditions and folkways will necessarily play a large role in the public life of a free society. Here is where federalism and subsidiarity come in. Through the long, messy, and often painful trial and error process that we call history, we have learned to promote freedom and virtue by orienting distant political institutions, primarily towards liberty, and nearby political institutions, primarily towards virtue. There will never be a complete and total separation. Washington will always have some legitimate concern with cultivating virtuous citizens, and City Hall will always be on the lookout for threats to our freedoms. But by and large, we recognize that the closer our politics is to hearth and home, the safer and more beneficial it is for citizens to act in concert to preserve and pursue shared values. No sane person wishes his home to resemble Seattle's now infamous Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Also, no sane person wishes to live in a society where every aspect of that society is regimented as a barracks. Ordered liberty, American style, is not merely the virtuous mean between two degraded political forms. It is uniquely freeing and ennobling because our constitutional inheritance at the national, state, and local levels empowers liberty to augment order and vice versa. State and local governments are well positioned to contribute to human flourishing in ways that would be impossible for the national government. Citizens often have different preferences for the mix of goods and services they expect the public sector to supply, as well as the tax prices they are willing to pay for them. Allowing citizens a degree of self-sorting into their preferred mix is often reasonable. Furthermore, decentralized governance, permits widespread experimentation. We Americans are a pragmatic people. While our fundamental values are fixed, the way we pursue them in policies and institutions ought not be. The boundary between private and public, and hence the combination of market, government, and civil society activities that enable us to live our best lives, should be regularly tried and tested. We see this playing out before our eyes on the contemporary political scene. American patriots have good reasons to cheer the nation's ongoing verdict on the comparative merits of the Texas-Florida governance model as compared to the California-New York governance model. Yet, things are far from satisfactory. Now we must confront an uncomfortable truth. Federalism as a constitutional principle is significantly weaker than it can and should be, and that is largely our fault. The story of eroded dignity and atrophied self-governance is not one of heavy-handed national usurpation. Municipal, county, and state officials have willingly ceded their power to Washington in exchange for secure cash flows and insulation from difficult yet necessary political decisions. Federalism and subsidiarity were not stolen from us. We gave them away. The Founding Fathers regarded the power of the purse as the ultimate locus of sovereignty. Even today, there is no surer indication of ruling than the ability to compel households and businesses to relinquish the fruits of their labor to serve causes they find objectionable. That is why the founders placed very tight restrictions on both the content and process of taxing and spending activities. Perhaps now we wish that those restrictions were even tighter. Degraded federalism, however, undermines those safeguards, even if the Constitution remains otherwise unbesmirched. If politicians can turn to external funds to evade the political burden of raising an internal revenue, the whole edifice comes crashing down. And that is where we are now. For lovers of ordered liberty, it is time to focus less on what is being decided and more on who decides. Many state and local officials boldly proclaim communal independence on the campaign trail. Yet, once safely ensconced in office, they attach themselves, remora-like, to the national tax base. We must be willing to send ostensibly conservative governors and state legislators packing if they accept a penny more in national funds beyond which is required by current statute. As we know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. We do not get to complain if we refuse to shoulder the fiscal and regulatory burdens of our own communal decisions. Lastly, we must always keep in mind, the mutual impingement of political and economic outcomes. Even a perfectly implemented program to restore ordered liberty will be of no avail if we cannot keep ordered liberty. Politically independent households and communities must have a stake in the social order. The mass of regulations and restrictions that prevent families from accumulating productive property and putting it to work are a major cause of local enfeeblement. Here, too, there is an opportunity to advance both freedom and virtue. Roll back Leviathan, and creative self-governance and entrepreneurship become complements instead of substitutes.
Ancient wisdom teaches us that order in the commonwealth reflects order in the soul. Should we be surprised our public affairs are in not great shape when our own loves are disordered? We often care more about distant capitals than our own homes and our own neighbors. Frankly, what business do we have governing a nation if we can't be bothered to join our parish council or give testimony before City Hall? To be clear, I am not advocating we retreat from public engagement or service at the national level. At minimum, these things will be necessary to return politics to its proper humane scale. But I am saying that all the time, effort, organization, and resources in the world will not do us any good if we concede the fundamental institutional prerequisites of ordered liberty. We can enjoy and practice freedom and virtue if we govern less and govern locally. We will enjoy neither if we predicate our public endeavors on the constitutional settlements decided by our enemies. Thank you.